The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Ben, what do you say about this?
I think that the key thing to know about Northern Ireland is that it is a very expensive place, and it's easily sustained by the United Kingdom, because the United Kingdom is a nation that is approaching 15 times, I think it's 14 times the size of the Republic of Ireland. So whatever the quibbles that economists make about the exact figure, the current subvention, the current difference between what we raise in taxes and what we cost the UK is approaching £10 billion. Now, I do edit a unionist newspaper, so obviously I look at things from a unionist perspective. And in fact, one of the criticisms that we would make as a paper and that we try to cover of unionists is there isn't sometimes an appreciation of the ease with which and the generosity with which Northern Ireland is funded. So I do think that any baseline figure for the Republic, if there is a strong desire to take over Northern Ireland, and there seems to have been something of a nationalist wave across the island in a number of respects, cultural, maybe exacerbated somewhat by Brexit. If there is that desire to take it over, then it's going to be a very expensive place to take, just on the basis of the figures that we already know. The money that is, as we would often describe it, pumped in to Northern Ireland with very little recognition from people here, not even as not much recognition, as I say, from unionists, as there should be. Yeah.
Now, the dependence of the Northern Ireland economy on the generosity of Westminster, I mean, so many jobs in Northern Ireland are dependent upon the state, the public service jobs. And in fact, last week, Henry McKean, our reporter, did an item on housing and how cheap it is in Northern Ireland compared to the Republic. And, you know, the people he talked to, most of them who had bought houses were actually working for the government in directly or indirectly.
Yeah, I think that we have, we do have actually the highest. There are two measurements of the scale of the public sector here. Actually, the number of people who work directly for the state, while it is, I think, the highest in the UK, it's still relatively small. It's in the low 30s, I believe, in terms of percentage, whereas in, I think, the lowest areas of the United Kingdom, the very wealthy parts of the southeast of England, I think it's in the high teens. So you still have in Northern Ireland 70% of people working for the private sector. However, there are two things. The first thing is that public sector wages are higher than private sector wages. That's a contentious area here because people say, well, it's often more likely to be what you would call white collar jobs. But even so, whatever way you look at it, that's a very, very big part of the economy, as your reporter found when he was looking at house prices here. There's another way of measuring it, which is the percent, and this is much higher, the percentage of the economy in Northern Ireland, the money that's swirling around, that is UK money. And that is huge. At some points, it's the highest in the UK. At some points, it's touched, I haven't up-to-date figures on that, it's touched more than 70%. And why is that? Well, it's not just about public sector employment. It's about vast benefits coming in. It's a vast pool of benefits. It's about pensions. It's about money, for example, in the times when there was the army was here. That's public sector money that's spent on contractors and so on and so forth. So we are deeply, deeply embedded into the UK economy, very dependent on it, probably too dependent on it. And then there's another thing that's happened, although, of course, this has changed with the Irish Sea border and the problems that have happened after Brexit. One of the things that the IRA was not able to do, it wasn't able to make this place other than a fully integrated part of the UK economy. It was a deeply, deeply integrated part of the economy. For example, the seamless movement, trucks coming over from Scotland, sometimes up from Holyhead, but nonetheless, ultimately movements within the UK. That was seamless. What could the IRA do when it changed? It changed its tactics and the sort of targeting that it did over the 30-year, we would say, terrorist campaign, but it couldn't. What could bomb boats in the Irish Sea? That wouldn't have, even if it had done that, it wouldn't have significantly changed it. So there has now been this change. And yet an interesting thing, and this is something that the government says, and this is something that those in the DUP who support the deal, is that we still, in spite of everything, in spite of the barrier that now exists there, are a very integrated part of the UK economy. Mm. And I think overturning that would be, as this report finds, whatever the details of it, would be a huge undertaking.
Before I go back to John, I think the line may have improved. Just wanted to ask you your reaction to the polling recently that suggested a majority in Scotland, a majority in Wales, a majority in England would happily allow Northern Ireland to become part of a united Ireland. That kind of public attitude eventually might be reflected in Westminster.
Yes, it is. Actually, that again, I could spend all the whole program talking about this. There has been there are different surveys on this, and there have been surveys that have shown that have been polling this since the 1980s. In fact, possibly before the 1980s, that have shown an increase, slight increase, in Northern Ireland support for Northern Ireland in what we would call the mainland. But I think that there's no question, again, I come back to the need for unionists not to be complacent. I think very many people in Great Britain, one of the things that we in Northern Ireland get frustrated by is you'll be talking to somebody in a call centre or whatever, and they'll say something about, well, I'm not sure whether we serve Ireland. They don't even know the distinction. Of course, that is a problem for people in Northern Ireland, and another thing to be wary of. At the same time, though, this embedded nature of Northern Ireland in the UK, the way that BBC will go to Scotland on big occasions, it will flash to pictures from Edinburgh, to pictures from Cardiff, to pictures from Belfast, let's say, some sort of national commemoration, and go back to London. I mean, and that, too, is noticed by very many people in the UK. But yes, it's ultimately a problem for us, and it's something that unionists have to work on. And it brings me back to the first point that I made, that if unionists are complacent, I mean, I know, obviously, for decades, I worked in London in the 1990s. I've followed politics there. I'm aware of feeling that has turned against Scotland latterly, of thinking, well, Scotland's whining too much. And Northern Ireland has been lucky that it hasn't been on the radar. We've been fortunate that many soldiers came here and there wasn't a backlash against us and many sacrificed with their lives. But yes, Northern Ireland doesn't want to start to be seen as whining, or that will make the unionist position more difficult again.
Now, Professor John Doyle, back to you. And you've heard Ben's arguments that the embedded nature of Northern Ireland into the United Kingdom is such that it would be both expensive but also culturally very difficult to extract it successfully. But your caveats about the report?
Yeah, I mean, to reply to Ben in the first instance, I mean, the key factor why the public sector is so strong in Northern Ireland is because the private sector is so weak. And that's true throughout the United Kingdom outside of the South East and London. If you look at tax versus revenues, London is the only region of the UK where tax revenues exceed expenditure in 9 years out of 10. And the South East is the only one in the modern era that's ever raised more taxes than it's spent. So it's a highly centralised economy living off London without the balancing regional expenditure you'd expect in that sort of centralised economy. So it is a case where, you know, Wales, Sunderland, Northern Ireland, the level of living standards, the level of public expenditure in no way reflects the overall averages of the United Kingdom. And that's the sort of, I suppose, underlying issue. But on the report itself, I think there's two key weaknesses in the report that I think undermine its projections as to what the cost would be. And the first is that it takes the current subvention, the difference between tax and revenues in Northern Ireland, as just folding over to the following day. And that assumes, for example, that defence expenditure would increase by roughly £1.5 billion pounds sterling the morning after United Ireland, including a nuclear deterrence, you know, which is clearly not going to happen. There'll be some increase in defence expenditure in the Republic over the next number of years anyway, but nothing of that scale. It assumes United Ireland would repay part of the UK debt, for which it would have no legal responsibility whatsoever and no requirement to repay any of it. There's no international law or contractual law that would require that. And it also assumes that the UK would walk away from its pensions responsibility. Legally, it could do this. I mean, the Irish government could open the Dáil in the morning and abolish the old age pension and tell teachers they weren't getting their pensions they contributed to every year. I mean, it's been well documented. It's a pay-as-you-go system. But politically, would a British government of the future really tell military veterans, police officers, nurses, that, sorry, you did pay every month into your pension, but did you not know that was just a tax? And we've suddenly decided, you're not paying your pension in Northern Ireland. But if you go live in Spain or if you go live in Dundalk, we will pay your pension because that's the current responsibility. So the subvention figure is not the starting point. The 10 billion that they use in that report, my own work, which has been peer reviewed and published in academic journals, suggests that if Britain does live up to its pension responsibilities, you know, moral rather than legal, I accept, the actual subvention is about $1.5 billion a year.
Mm.
And if Britain doesn't pay anything towards those pensions, it's about $4.5 billion. So, I mean, very, very different figures. And
okay,
the second
but certain things would have to happen. Obviously, even if Britain did adhere to its pension obligations and any other social obligations that had been accumulated by people living in Northern Ireland, the levels of payment, for example, for job seekers are very different in Northern Ireland than they are in the Republic. There's a massive civil service in Belfast. Many people would have to be made redundant either there or in the civil service in Dublin. And Turkey's voting for Christmas within the civil services north and south does not strike me as likely.
I don't accept that, Pat. I don't at all. I think there's no question of making people redundant. Anyone proposing that would...
Why would you have double everything? A double Department of Health, a double Department of Education. Surely,
because
you know, there would have to be a rationalisation.
Because you'll have 40% more people. There'll be prorated numbers of schools. I mean, the question is, in Northern Ireland, the level of jobs created by foreign direct investment, allowing for population difference, is about 20% of the level in the south. Belfast is operating economically at about 20% of the level of Cork and Kerry. And what the report from John Fitzgerald says is that none of that would change over the first 20 years of United Ireland. And for me, that's not credible. None of us can predict the future. But the notion that with the same tax policy, the same foreign direct investment policy, the same IDA out about the world, that Belfast would continue to be one-fifth of the level of Cork and Kerry, and that there would be no economic improvement despite the exact same public policy being in place, it's just not credible. Of course there will be economic growth in Northern Ireland in those circumstances, but a different regional policy and a different tax policy, there's no reason to believe it would remain the private sector disaster that it is today. And when there's private sector job, there's no unemployment in Northern Ireland.
Yeah. Well, we know that because of the activities of the IRA and other paramilitaries, the economy in Northern Ireland kind of stalled for many years of the Troubles. So there is no doubt without the Troubles, the economy would have probably grown, not maybe as fast as that in the Dublin region, but certainly it would have grown. But here's the rub. You would surely have to assume that there would be no Troubles from loyalist paramilitaries, thus creating that economic stall all over again.
There's two things there. One, of course, the conflict had an impact on the Northern Ireland economy. But the real issue is, why has there been no improvement in the 26 years now since the Good Friday Agreement? Productivity, a really good report from the SRI last year, showed that productivity, which is basically the underlying economy that drives wages, was almost identical north and south in 1998. And the south is now 40% higher, even when you strip out the distorting effect of multinationals. And that fundamentally drives a low-wage economy in Northern Ireland, where despite 3% unemployment, 27% of people recently were claiming universal credit, topping up really low wages from the private sector in most cases.
So what's your analysis of why, even since the Good Friday Agreement, and you know it was not all sweetness and light after the Good Friday Agreement, there were still lots of problems both in government and bureaucratically and all the rest of it. But what is your explanation for the economy not suddenly taking off?
I think there's two key factors. One, I agree with John Fitzgerald and Edgar, is education. The number of people leaving school without any qualifications in the north is over twice what it is in the Republic. There's almost no post-leaving cert education. The number of people finishing A-levels is very low. The number of graduates in the economy is very low. So the skills level is low, and that I agree. I just think it would change quicker because so many of those people, not that they don't graduate, is to go live in England. And if there was a vibrant private sector economy, they might return home. The second one is harder to see shifting in the short term. And that is the sort of underlying sort of economic basis of the private sector in Northern Ireland, the sort of just the lack. We're doing a piece of research at the moment with the University of Ulster on the underlying reason why there's been no uptick in foreign direct investment since 1998. When everybody, if you go back and look at the newspapers or radio coverage of 1998, everybody spoke about a bit of a crass phase, but the peace dividend that would follow long-term ceasefire. And what we're finding, and we're not finished the research yet, we want to do some more, is actually with the new OECD deal on tax, tax is no longer the huge competitive advantage for the Republic it once was. You can get a cheaper rate in the Baltics if tax is all you're after. It's the mixture of skills and stability is the thing that people talk about. Again, it's their number one, actually ahead of... And if you look at, obviously, during the conflicts, there was no political stability. Then we had a power-sharing agreement, but it was 50% of the time it didn't exist. Then just as we were getting through two phases with the Martin McGuinness and Paisley era into Peter Robinson of relative stability, Brexit happens. Then if you're someone looking to make a 10-year investment in Northern Ireland, will you be in the single market? Will you be out of single market? Will corporation tax be 18% or 35%? These things have changed radically in the UK and in Northern Ireland in recent years. And there's never been a period where a big investor is going to say, I pretty much know where this country is going to be in terms of tax and its attitude to the European Union in 10 years.
Back to you, Ben. I mean, there is this rising tide might carry all boats north and south, certainly allowing Belfast to develop dramatically. And recently talking to many of the movers and shakers in Belfast at an event here in Dublin, and they're very optimistic about what is happening in that city in terms of direct foreign investment, getting people to live in the city where before they may have avoided it. Belfast is growing. It's an exciting place. But in the event of some sort of United Ireland, what about a loyalist paramilitary reaction that would interfere with that process?
Can I just briefly, before I answer that very important question, say I was actually born in 1971, at the end of 71, when the Northern Ireland troubles were approaching their peak. And I always say that people of my generation, my school years, people born late 71, early 72, born at the height of the troubles, saw the normalization of Northern Ireland, because we don't remember 72, of course. We remember the opening of the Opera House in Belfast in 1980. We remember restaurants beginning to appear in the early 1980s. Remember Belfast becoming really, we just about remember the end of the big security cordon around Belfast and having to get checked very carefully before going into shops, and then it beginning to thrive. Now, who was the handmaiden for that? Who was what was the force that made this actually quite a prosperous? It's a very complicated thing. We've also got very good schools, by the way, for example, grammar schools. It was the UK government and the money. Now, I'm not just saying that to say that Britain is great. As I said, I think there's been a complacency in unionism. And I think a lot of the problems in Northern Ireland is something to do with a handout culture. It's like being in a wealthy family. The UK is an immensely wealthy country. It's the sixth, by some measures, the fifth or sixth wealthiest country on earth. And I think that like the problems that arise from the offspring of wealthy families, you expect it to go on. So that's a big challenge. With regard to loyalist backlash, well, I would hope that there would not be violence. And one of the things that has been interesting about the Irish Sea border is that violence, I mean, there was a bus burned out and there were riots for a while. Violence hasn't been part of the mix. So I hope that there wouldn't be violence. Nonetheless, I think it's important that unionists register their concerns about some of the things that are happening. I mean, you know, it's not just a matter of how unionists and loyalists react to these things. I think that there has been a retrospective vindication of the IRA and the Republic, and in fact, across nationalist Ireland. I think it's to do with a generation. I talk about my generation. It's to do with a generation that has no memory of the Troubles at all. And one of the things that I've often said in columns that I've written is that people in Northern Ireland should recognize the extent to which, because there's resentments on both sides about things that happened in the Troubles. Recognize that the Republic of Ireland from the early 1980s, when Sinn Féin began contesting elections, comprehensively rejected any IRA campaign at the ballot box, the party that defended it, until after the ceasefires and until the end of the 1990s when Sinn Féin began to rise in the Republic. So I think that what am I saying in that? I'm saying is that there was never support on either side, never political support on either side of the community. And there's absolutely no support for the loyalist paramilitaries when they stood as parties. They got like 2 or 3%, 4%, that kind of thing. And I hope that that wouldn't be a problem. But if the Republic is going to change the history, if you're going to have even national sporting teams singing Ooh Ah Up the Ra, if you're going to have polls saying that you won't even join the harmless association of the Commonwealth, you won't even consider changing your flag, you won't consider changing your anthem, I would say, from a unionist perspective, well, look, we have essentially a two-state solution on this island. We have two jurisdictions, and that you in the South went your own way, broke away from an extraordinary country, flawed but wonderful country, the United Kingdom. You found it very difficult for the first 50 years and have since then carved out a very impressive place as a small country. But in the same way, in the same the arguments for people in the UK who said, well, let's not leave this 500 million European Union, they pertain all the more because a European Union isn't a nation state. When we're part of this big nation state, we need to think about it. We need to be grateful for the benefits. We don't want to leave. And those are the arguments. All right. I don't see any appetite to bring it back to your question. I thank goodness I don't see any significant appetite for violence on either side of the community now. Ben, and probably, I hope, ever.
Thank you very much for joining us. Ben Lowry, who's editor of the Belfast Newsletter. And a final question for you, Professor John Doyle. Your guest thinks that 20 million, billion per year for 20 years is a gross overestimation, but can he put his potential figure on it? Because without a doubt, there would be a cost. John?
Yeah, the research I've done suggests that depending on the Britain's attitude to pensions, which you won't know about until after a referendum and those negotiations in the government, is somewhere between 1 and 4 billion. So not a small amount of money. I'm not saying it is a tiny amount of money, but it's manageable. Also, our debt-GDP ratio would drop significantly because our GDP would go up and our debt wouldn't. So there would be a requirement for growth. And I think when you look at the what would be the basis for that growth, it only requires Northern Ireland to reflect the level of tourism and foreign direct investment, roughly speaking, of Cork and Kerry. It doesn't have to be San Diego. And there will be a transition to that. I don't think it will be 20 years. So for me, I think it's manageable on day one. And there's a reasonable basis for believing that that level of growth is not only possible, but indeed very likely in certainly the Belfast region and in the Derry-Donegal region.
Professor John Doyle, Vice President for Research in Dublin City University. Thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.